So to insist that Zen alone is exempt from the force of its own critique, that Zen is the moon toward which other religions merely point, that Zen is the real rice cake where all the others are painted, that's where I think you begin to enter the realm of hubris, and there's a real risk of faking it. Thank you.
Sunday churchgoer isn't, you know, and so forth. Could you read those couple of paragraphs again?
If you
confuse
the two,
kind of
right in there.
Because I think I missed it. I think I didn't get it. So. It's in the last page or two.
So I think, is this it? From this perspective, the notion that the Sunday Christian is hypocritical or insincere or inauthentic misses the point. Right? Because if they behaved during the week the way they behaved on Sundays, there wouldn't be any point in Sundays or Christians. Or so that ritual separates things out, marks them as... Is this?
Yeah.
Ritual separates things out. It marks them as special precisely to underscore the gap between the way we would like things to be if we had sufficient control over the situation. Ritual is all about control. Right? And the way things necessarily are. It's a really simple point. And again, I'm not saying it's right. I think it's a very, very powerful and interesting theory. But what it's saying is, well, if you're spending all this time making this special, right? And I think it's hard to deny that Zen temples are all about marking things apart. It's a monastic tradition. It's apart. Well, that apartness, he's saying, look at the obvious facts here. The obvious facts here is that it is set apart. And why do human beings do that? Human beings do that because we don't have control. It is absolutely essential that we transmit through the generations certain ideals that allow our society to function, you know, in certain ways. And there are very powerful ideas that we're capable of transmitting. But these ideas always exist in some tension with the real world. And again, if they didn't, there would be no need for these religious traditions. That religious traditions exist is a response to the gap between who we are and who we would like to be. And that to lose that is to miss something very obvious.
I think that from inside the tradition, it would be more like the gap between how things really are and how they are in our confusion, rather than how things really are and how we would want them to be. And I think that's you could say that those two statements are exactly the equivalent. You know what I mean? But it feels different from within the tradition.
I understand, and that's why this is just personal, but I thought a lot about whether I wanted to talk about this today.
Thanks for doing it.
Because what I'll tell you a little bit of background here. I decided if you're going to invite scholars to come and talk, you know, even sympathetic scholars who also happen to be priests like me, it's important that scholars come clean. Because I often feel that when we're involved in these dialogues, we've talked about it before, that often the Zen teachers are not coming clean. But then I thought, well, you know, I never really come clean. I do think that there is real power. There's tremendous power in the Zen tradition. I also think there's a kind of power in the academic tradition that is often not fully appreciated. And one of the things that happens regularly in Western religious traditions is they can have this conversation because they're just much more, you know, they've been having this conversation for hundreds of years. And so these two perspectives are not alien. In fact, much contemporary Christian theology is an attempt to grapple with the gap between these two perspectives. But, you know, in the Buddhist side, the grappling doesn't even happen, and it's partly because nobody even admits that there's two radically different perspectives here. But the reason I think this perspective is important is, well, I actually think it's enlightening. I mean, I really do see it in the spirit of Nagarjuna. If the idea is to let go of everything, then why are you want to hold on to the one thing that you know is that we may not be able to aspire to it, but the tradition has the truth. Right? Well, that's not what Nagarjuna said.
Yeah.
Nagarjuna said, well, you can't say, you can't say, and you can't whistle either.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, the truth is a painted rice cake, too. Exactly. But when we say how we'd like it to be, the implication there is that it isn't that way. Whereas what I would say is that it isn't that it is that way or it isn't that way. Do you know what I mean? That in other words, there's a determination being made there. The way we would like it to be, in parenthesis, and it actually isn't that way. It's actually more indeterminate than that. We don't know the way it is, or it isn't. It is necessarily this way or that way, but it's more confused or more dark than that.
I have many different responses. Part of the response is, I think a bit of what you're saying, not all of it, but a little bit of it, is it's okay for someone within the tradition to speak that way, but not someone from the outside.
No,
I'm saying that because if someone from the inside says, "What you think that there's a there." I mean, Nagarjuna is just Nagarjuna 101 is, if the object of Buddhism is to let go of everything, then you let go of everything, right? That's what it really means. Now, what Zen does is it realizes that only works if it's still in the context of a practice, right? So you have a practice, and then you have every aspect of that practice is designed so that you don't reify an object of attainment or a goal and so on.
When you said tension, you said conscious tension. Right?
And this is something a lot of scholars, and this gets into a technical thing, a lot of scholars find that the slipperiest part of Smith's theory. So what exactly is the status of this knowing? Right? To say, in other words, that there's a kind of, among Christians, there is, including the most heartfelt and fervent fundamentalists, there is some aspect of their being that understands that there's a certain kind of
agreement.
That there's this gap, gap there. And that's very difficult. It's difficult for me to get a hold of exactly what he means by that. But I do have a sense that he's onto something. And that's why I just thought I'd share it. Yeah.
Where you started with the painted rice cake is really interesting. And then to talk about ritual, it's not so important to me about whether there's knowing or not knowing, but what both of those activities, not experience, activities denote is a sense of agency and creativity, which is a function of sentience. So to go back where we had this small exchange about the word spirit of trees and grasses, I don't know what the actual word is, we have to look at it, but I don't necessarily identify spirit and sentience and this is going back to the original argument, I'm not sure that green trees and grasses are capable of agency or creativity in the sense that a sentient being is, who can paint a rice cake, perform a ritual, kill a bear, any of those things, which seems to be the marker of sentience. And that seems to be the real territory for me. And that's my bias. That's the territory in which I'm working, which includes some responsibility for all of life, which might include all growing things. But, you know, in the precepts that Gill framed for us, the first precept, I think, was not harming breathing things in the original language, which is, boy, we don't use that. But if that's really an early territory of Buddhism, then there's a question about, then we're back in this argument about sentience and insentience, in which I would come down on the sentience side, I suppose.
Well, it's, to me, it goes right back to the very heart of the Anatman doctrine. You know, the notion that there really is no self here, there's just a kind of unfolding of karmic inertia and so on, and that our sense of a solid self is profoundly misguided.
Right, and yet there's creativity.
The last thing I'm doing there is disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to translate creativity into an early Buddhist.
Right.
Like, how would they have kind of grappled with that?
I don't know.
I was just reading a text yesterday with my graduate students, actually, which was coming down against the Buddha nature of insentient objects, and it was contrasting insentient things to a divine drum. Very bizarre, because what they were saying is, well, the divine drum actually preaches the Dharma. This is something you find in the Pure Lands. There are these drums and gongs and instruments which continually manifest. Now, I think that's your creativity.
Yeah.
And they were saying, well, the issue with insentience is whether or not there is a kind of vitality there. And grass and trees don't have that, but divine drums do. Mm-hmm. It was very... Well, where in the debate are they? They seem to be looking for some kind of medial position there.
That may be what I'm trying to do.
In
Uttapadaishan, Master Yogin speaks of the tonal shen mind of grass and trees. He seems to be making the point that it's a kind of mind that we share with the insentient, seemingly insentient world. And that sentience itself is, in a sense, radiated in that sense. So I wonder if you could speak more to that and the idea, perhaps, that the presence of Buddha nature in, say, the insentient world is not a question of whether or not objects have Buddha nature, but how. And I think the idea of mind only is the way they have Buddha nature is in the non-separation of self and other, Dharma.
Well, maybe this, someone asked earlier, again, what, at the end of the day, what is this Busho anyways? What is Buddha nature? Let me tell you the way, as a scholar, I would look at it. There are two traditions in Buddhism. And this actually isn't mine. This is a very general way that scholars look at this stuff now. And they exist in tension. One, we generally call the Tathagatagarbha tradition, but it's also the Busho stuff. And the truth about it is, if you really look at the texts that push that point of view, they're pretty Hindu, right? They're talking about an Atman. They're talking about a substratum, completely enveloping consciousness, which knows no differentiation, and which, they have different ways of thinking about it. It's really hard to look at that and say, this is Hinduism. Then you have this very critical Madhyamika tradition. Now, the Yogacara, the Chitta Matra, the mind-only stuff, it's way over there on the Busho, the Buddha nature side of things. Although they try not to be. They try to do a dance and show that, yes, everything is consciousness. Consciousness is empty, but right, the moment you say that, you acknowledge that there's something there. Right? Whoever is saying that everything is empty. So the way that, as a scholar, I look at this stuff is... this is what the Buddhist tradition inherited. They were working with this stuff. It's not their fault. Right? The early church fathers ended up with Christ is divine and Christ is human. Right? If you know anything about Platonic philosophy, cannot be. Right? Those are antithetical. The contradictions, Christ is both. And this gave rise to a very fruitful tradition for a couple thousand years of people using that to think through fundamental human problems. So to me, this is, so Dogen and virtually all of these Buddhist masters, they were trying to work this stuff through. And they have both of these things going at the same time. One is this kind of very critical tradition that says don't hold up anything. And at times you can see that comes through, you know, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. There's no question that's on the Madhyamika side there. But, you know, the next sentence, they're back into talking about universal Buddha nature. And all I can do is say, this is really interesting to me because they're asking very deep, they're thinking through what I think are some very deep and meaningful and available questions. And this is the language, these are the tools that they have to talk about and debate and think these things through.
This is part of the duality or conflict coming into play. In the same way that it does in science, where you try to describe so-called objective reality, it does not have an observer. Whereas in Buddhism, the observer, the self, has been there from the beginning. So the Yogacara school of mind only, so forth, the scientific question, how do they have Buddha nature, if they have Buddha nature? And it has to include the observer. I don't think the Buddhist answer is that this fabric itself has Buddha nature. It has Buddha nature by nature of its relationship to our consciousness.
So that's where the two sides, I think, have different responses. The Madhyamika side, you know, the easiest way that, you know, I used to explain to my students Madhyamika is it means there is no stepping outside. Right? Whatever we mean by reality, it can't be reality from a particular perspective. Right? It must be reality bereft of any perspective. But that means that we are not in a position ever to get at it. Right? So that's kind of the pure Madhyamika. It means drop anything you think you know because it's all from a particular relative perspective. Now, get that. They're saying drop it all. Not drop it all and then you'll realize the truth, but drop it all and your problems will go away.
That is the truth.
Yeah. So that's the Madhyamika position. Now, but the Yogacara position is different. They say the very act of doing, they say there's something fundamentally disingenuous about imagining non-imagining.
Did you say disingenuous?
Disingenuous, thank you. There's something fraudulent about that because the reality is the entire thing is a human enterprise. Right? So that in contemporary terms, if you look at contemporary philosophy of mind, that's, you know, this argument is still going on. By the way, it's a bit of an aside, but what I've been reading a lot these days about, it's a technical, let me back up. There are people out there who think that cognitive science is going to explain religion. And it's going to explain religion because cognitive science has shown that there are certain subsystems in the brain, modules, that do things that seem to be extremely important in religion. One of them is that we are hardwired to distinguish between sentient and insentient. This is something that there is a kind of sub-circuit. And there's some very interesting empirical data to show this. Their childhood studies of very young children, that they seem to have an implicit understanding that causality is different for sentient and insentient. Then there's another system that has to do with recognition of sentience, and it has to do with facial recognition. Basically, the cognitive psychologists who are interested in religion think religion is a big category mistake. We go around projecting sentience onto things that don't have sentience, right? So that's why not many scholars of religion take this stuff seriously. But what is really interesting is this notion that the distinction between sentient and insentient is hardwired. What that means is it's not absolute. It means we're creating a distinction, we're bringing a distinction to the world that is not a discovery, it's not a childhood discovery of some basic metaphysical distinction out there. But somehow the world may not know that distinction. Then it begins to look like the Buddhists were onto something very interesting when they begin to struggle with it themselves. In a sense, they're trying to think their way out of that distinction. Yeah.
Professor, we're born deluded, but that says we're born, this is original sin, we're born deluded. Could we go
go back at this from another side, back to the ritual side, because I was fascinated by that too. You said ritual separates things out. Nodded. In order to mark the gap between secular and sacred. Yeah.
Well, just to say, I wouldn't say, I'd say the gap is created by marking out, right? It's not that the gap pre-exists. It's probably what you meant. But I'm just, I want to be, this gets tricky, because
okay,
I want to be sure.
I did say that that ritual actually separates, is a way of describing and marking separation.
Yeah.
And that this isn't, then that this is in order to preserve our ideal. That was a new sense of what you said. So then ritual is intending to set off and set apart and preserve our ideals so we can also, we have our ideals, we have our messy world. And when I like this. This is really interesting. And then I say, well, what I actually am trying to do is to use ritual, zazen, and the forms to enact my ideal of oneness rather than to mark off the gap. So in a sense, I'm trying to do both simultaneously with ritual, is what it looks like.
That's basically Smith's. Well, what
he
Smith is saying.
To enact the oneness of that. He's saying to do.
Oh no! What he says is that it's absolutely essential that we give form to and transmit from generation to generation these ideals, because these ideals is what makes us human. In other words, it is important. Why it's important for the bear hunters to have a sense that they live in a kind of a communitas with the bears. That's another story, but it is important for them. It's absolutely essential to them transmitting deep values in their culture from parents to children. And so they have to have a way to give form to these values, and that's what the bear rituals do.
Right. Well, our trope is to say that we're doing it, we're not just creating an ideal and handing the ideal on.
Yes. Yeah.
What? Because I think a little different.
Is that...
They're enacting a ritual once in a while about a bear. We're sort of claiming that we're enacting this ritual as our reality when we sit down for the zazen.
Maybe I'm just not understanding you, but the bear hunters would say, I mean, again, they're going to say, no, this is really the way we hunt bears. When anthropologists went in and asked them, how do you hunt a bear?
Right, I understand. It's a normative enough.
Right. So they, in other words, are they really doing something... at that level of kind of abstraction, is it really that different? Because they don't think that the rituals are in... I know it sounds like I'm saying we're all perfectly capable, we're all perfectly aware, consciously, that there's a gap between the way we enact the world in the perfect environment of the Zendo and often who we find ourselves being when we're outside that world. Right? Now, I'm saying most of us, I can't speak for you, but to me, that gap, I only experience most of the time as anxiety. Like that's how it actually manifests. But I think Smith would say that exploring that anxiety, that's where there is a tacit awareness that there's a gap. It's not as if we're conscious that.
Awareness of the
gap. So really what Smith is offering, and I'm playing, of course, with Dogen, I'm saying what Dogen is offering, in a sense, is celebrating that gap, rather than finding oneself constantly, you know, under the burden of this anxiety. And that anxiety, I think, is heightened because of a certain hubris, which again, may not exist anymore, but certainly 30 years ago when I first got involved with this, the anxiety was very intense because there really was a sense in which the Zendo was not where it's at. It's daily life where it was at. And there was this constant sense that I had that I could never live up to this model of enlightenment that was being drummed into me in the Zendo.
Well, I think we're trying to be a different drum in the Zendo.
I'm sure.
But I think in a way it seems to muddy the different drums in the out.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting is, first of all, did you say you were ordained at Koyasan?
No, at Kofuji.
Okay, so that's very different. But what interests me is this idea about the rice cake feeding, I can't remember exactly how the phrase goes, but this ritual actually feeding the practitioner. Because I think there, you know, in its purest sense, there isn't any difference between the ritual and the practice, everyday practice, in the sense they're both the same thing. But there is something about that, making that kind of mythologizing, that kind of heightened energy around the ritual itself and the specialness and the forms and all those things, that does feed us as practitioners, particularly, I think, even new people who are newer to the practice, and encourages them and gives them an energy to go forth and a kind of sense of confidence, if you will, although often confused about the difference between formal practice and everyday life, and confused about how to join those two things. But it definitely does feed one's practice, I think, and encourage it, and encourage one to go forward. So I think that's just interesting that those, the way you talk about that, to think about it that way.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm going to be clear at all here, but I'm wondering, because we're really talking about, I think, our viewpoint on reality, and that maybe in the reversal today of what you experienced, we run the danger of saying that this ideal created situation of all the rituals we have here, there is where reality lies. This is where I'll find it, not out here. So you have the same problem. You have a tremendous tension. But it seems to me where we run into the big issue is if I say to myself, well, here in Zazen, here in my prostrations, is the answer to what is reality? Because it is, for me, it is an idealized situation. I have made up, or I've accepted when I've stumbled into it, you know, a way that is artificial in a certain sense, quite deliberately so. And the more I tell myself that this is where I will find it, the bigger the gap gets with that other stuff, you know, the gap between daily life. So that a lot of our problems, I think, are that we lie to ourselves, or maybe we don't lie to ourselves, but we're constantly trying to put our finger on this is real, this is ideal, and of course, they, you know, it can be anywhere we point. But I sometimes feel that in the ritualized practice that we do, we are running the danger of not knowing that when I point at Zazen or Sesshin, that is a viewpoint. So I'm in danger of sort of selling that as this is where it is. We don't know where it is. It's actually with us, but...
So I'm not sure if this is a response to that or not. I mean, I think I hear where you come. I don't have answers.
I'm trying to figure it out.
A lot of what, or mostly what I wanted to say today is, if you have some confidence in what Zen is, I suppose as Zen teachers, it's very important to enact that. On the other hand, if you look at the tradition was constantly fighting. And they were fighting not because they were petty, but because they were deep. They were really trying to figure this stuff out. And you might say, well, it's because you can't figure it out discursively, you just have to realize it. But that, you know, they were talking about that too, and they said, no, it's not so easy. So what the tradition, and here I'll put my cards on the table, so you said, what was this tradition, if it's not about some very clear experience or understanding of the truth, what it was about is an institution which could embody the set of values and questions and transmit it from generation to generation to generation. So it might, you know, Kyogen's Man of Retreat, right? Someone comes along and says, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? That's like, by the way, it's very similar to the question, does a dog have Buddha nature? Because what you're supposed to know is what the answer is. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Yes, that's the answer. And you only understand, or know only makes sense if you know that the answer is yes. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? To transmit the Dharma. That's the answer. But of course, the moment you say that, right, you reify the Dharma, you think that there's a Dharma that can be transmitted, and you fall to your death. But again, what is presupposed there is the man has to answer. The image doesn't work unless you understand that an answer, you know all this, you know, percentage, but the answer has to be given. So that's my, really, why, in a sense, what I'm trying to do is say, look, all this ritual stuff, it's not the chaff. Right? That's how it moves from generation to generation. And maybe I'm not talking to you, I'm just talking to myself as a 20-year-old. Sometimes I... yeah.
There's a lot of things that I would like to answer to, but you know, my teacher always said Buddhism is not perfect. It's not yet. It's always developing, so it doesn't have an ending. It's up to us to find out what it is in our particular time and place, and we draw on all of the history to help us do that. So it's really up to us to find out what it is, and there's no specific answer. And in that sense, you know, we always accept what we're playing with these concepts, and with these. I think that's what gives vitality to our practice. Otherwise, you know, it's not something that came down from on high, even though. So we have this freedom to actually explore what it really is. So, I mean, in that sense, I think that's what you're saying, too.
Yeah.
The bear example is really interesting because I think that from our, you know, 20th century materialistic point of view, it's obvious to us that what really happens is what really happens in the real world, and that the ritual is not real. The ritual is they're cooking something up to make them feel better. That's the way, that would be the way to view it. But I think what Dogen's painting of the rice cake, the way I understand it, is that the ritual is real and not real. And the killing of the bear in the forest is real and not real.
Now I understand your question from before. Now, okay, so the bear, this is just, again, presupposed from an anthropological perspective, that the values that are being transmitted among these Siberian bear hunters, these are the foundations of their human lives.
Right.
They are, I think, do I want to say, yeah, they are more real than the butchering of the bear in real life. Because these are the things that give their life meaning that allow them to continue from generation to generation.
So it's
easy to read what I'm saying as, oh, what's real is they go out and they butcher this bear. And then they fake it in the ritual. That's not what's meant to say.
So I think the analogy is exactly the same for us. That the real life and the ritual life are both real and not real, and we know that, and we, just the same way that they have to hand down the ritual of bear, we have to hand down the ritual. We've been talking about this, the lineage paper and the robe, we have to hand that down because it carries, you know, this deep meaning for us. And I think that maybe the only difference is that we have this ideology of Nagarjuna where we can say both these worlds are real and not real, whereas probably the bear hunters wouldn't say that. They would probably say the ritual is real.
The only
difference, but otherwise it really is exactly the same to me, as you told me.
And it has to be handed down through the body.
As a ritual is always in the body.
It has to be, to me, that's the distinction. It has to be through the body.
Yeah.
That
Zazen is a ritual. In other words, for us, I mean, even apart from the robes and all that, the Zazen itself, as Dogen sees it, is itself the most fundamental of all the rituals.
Now, I would, I completely agree, and particularly agree with the body stuff, but that's where, unless it's embodied, it cannot be transmitted from generation to generation. It doesn't take root. This is a little side issue, but I think it's frequently thought that a particular ethical perspective will emerge naturally from meditation practice. And this is one where, just empirically, it is so patently untrue, right, that those ethical intuitions are created typically at a very, very early age and largely through bodily practices. And this is just a little shtick that I have. I think this is very important in the transmission of Buddhism to the West, because the tendency is to extract it from, I know we're talking about precepts, but to kind of extract it from its kind of moral foundation in the confidence that, oh, that stuff will all just kind of naturally flow out of a more enlightened consciousness. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure you're all familiar with Zen at War and all these other books that have come out.
I was astonished to find myself, just as you ended your talk, just burst into tears. And I realized it was heartbroken. And I'm reminded of Phil Hawker, what we were talking about, our life is vow and repentance. We make our vow, we make our best effort, we see our limitations, we can do our best. Somehow, you just put it so clearly.
I wanted to confess to noticing that while sitting here, a number of times I recognized that I was listening to you as a representative of the Academy, and that the Academy in the West has received some of the special charism of the scientist, who is held to be the privileged observer. But I think I want to remind myself and the rest of us that there's a sociology of sociologists, there's a sociology of Professor Smith, Professor Sharp, and that the critique is basically circular, and that as perhaps Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti remind us, there's an emptiness of emptiness. And indeed, you don't get to step outside, point back, and say, this is what's really going on. So I feel like, for me, that's very important to remember.
Yeah?
I'm just a little concerned at the way you're looking at some of the great koans as ritual embodiments or as space for some kind of debate. Really doesn't get to the fundamental question of what is it that's alive? What is it that's sentient? What is it that changes? Doesn't really address these questions which these great poems that we're all looking at. So all that you talked about was human nature, sentient being. What is human nature? What are sentient beings? What is it that's real? What is it that's not real? I feel like we have this container that we're all part of here, so there's a human tradition, which is a container, a social container that we all move within and we all function within. But these deep fundamental questions, if we are not really looking at those deep fundamental questions, if we're not really, we ignore them, then I think that we've missed some real blood that's in tradition. So, what is sentient?
You're asking me. I have no idea. That's why what I find interesting are in whether it's in the Buddhist tradition or it's in contemporary philosophy of mind or in contemporary cognitive neuroscience. The one thing they all agree on is there's a very profound and interesting mystery here. But again, I'm not sure. I don't mean to sound defensive, but I think what I'm saying is that if you have an answer to that, you might be right, but I'm sure that there were a lot of people within your own tradition in the past who may not have agreed.
I don't think the great mystery is a matter of right or wrong. I don't think the great mystery is a matter of having it or having not. And I think that the tendency in order to make things accessible to our rational mind, we tend to like put them in boxes and make these careful discriminations. I don't think the great mystery can be done in that way. I think the great mystery has to be investigated in a different way. So I'm just trying to make sure we don't get off on the words that you're talking about and these categories you're putting in, because this intuition is really about this great mystery, which involves not knowing. It involves this direct experience of the great mystery. I'd like to make a comment that takes one step up back from this whole conversation, sort of a meta comment, and that is that before, when we were sitting down, you asked us, do we ever engage, you know, these deep questions about the tradition, or are you at odds? You represent so many lineages. And we all said, no, we're not at odds. We actually get along really well. And it's
one big happy family.
Yeah,
you said we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
No, that's very different.
So I would say, you know, we actually get along quite well, and we feel like we share a basic Soto Zen point of view. But I actually think we do. But what's interesting to me is that I think I've been to all these meetings, and I actually think this is the first time we've had a conversation about these, you know, deeper matters in the tradition. And I find it, you know, really fun and really wonderful. And I actually think that we would not be able to have the conversation without you. Because I think if one of us stood up, and we're all capable of doing it, all of us could stood up and give a really great Dharma talk, it would all sound like shop talk. Because we're all in the business, you know. And we would not be able to kind of get below that to have the conversation. So I'm just appreciating, and the other scholars that we've had coming have been lots of times talking about historical things, which have been very valuable and important, but not about, you're actually gave a talk, which, as you pointed out, was nerdy and kind of wonderful that you did this, about...
Because I know what my colleagues do when they come.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? They know. They want to be really polite.
Yeah. So I think, I'm not just saying that. I just noted that in order for us to have a good conversation like this, we probably need you or somebody who's willing to do what you did today for us to have the conversation in a way.
But, you know, in the old days, you guys would, there'd be two high seats here, and you get two people up, and they debate.
Yeah.
Right, this was what the history of Japanese Buddhism.
Well, we don't know. We have not figured out how to do that. It doesn't work for us.
And again, the debates, just to reiterate, you know, the debates, it's not like who won or who lost. Yeah. It's that the debate was where the action was.
Yeah.
I would like to bring it back to the precepts, because it's really easy to think things in the midst of a ritual. It's really easy to carry a view in the midst of a ritual and to not be conscious in the midst of everyday activity. So I guess I want to ask if it's authentic, if it's possible to authentically practice the precepts.
You know, I don't know that. I know that there's been a conversation that, as I understand, has gone on for years about the precepts at Zen Center and the Soto School. Here, I really feel. Let me give you just my perspective on it, which may not kind of be in sync with what you're doing, but it really comes out of what happened in Japan in the late 19th and early 20th century when they gave up monastic celibacy. And you are heirs to that. And the Japanese have not worked this out. And they will be the first to concede that they haven't worked it out, which means you guys are on your own.
I'm asking about now.
Huh?
I'm asking about now. So, for instance, let's say I vow not to kill. I vow not to kill. So is following the rule about not killing, is that authentic? What would be, I mean, there's a rule about not killing, so if I eat vegetarian food and, you know, do the JJ, the dust mop and all that stuff, is that authentic? Or if I feel like I'm one body with all beings, is that authentic? What's authentic? And is it possible to do it?
You're still killing the carrot.
No, I'm just asking whether, I know there's problems.
But I guess what I'm asking is if you're looking for the tradition to give you guidance on this, this is an area in which historically, 2,500 years, there's no tradition to fall upon, because this was intended to be, at least originally, a monastic tradition. And that had all sorts of advantages. It meant that there were a lot of ready answers. You ate the food that was served to you, whatever was put in your bowl originally. Right, so that you're off the hook. When the Japanese tradition gave up the kind of, the comfort of this monastic structure, which they did very radically, you don't know about them. I mean, at that point, they're going into the future, and they had no idea where it was going to go. And if you sit with Japanese priests today, and not just Zen, but in virtually any tradition, they all find this to be the issue. They really don't know what it means to be a priest, a bodhisattva. And they talk about it, and they struggle, but it's not an issue in which there are a lot of certainties. Unlike other things, you can talk about the Buddha nature of insentient objects, and you have lots of certainties. They may not agree with each other, but on this issue of precepts, I don't get that sense. And the Zen tradition, I actually don't know that much about Japanese Soto, but Japanese and Insai, they really now have embodied the contradiction in that a Soto Roshi, right? So a Roshi who is teaching in a monastic training hall, is expected to be celibate. It's not written anywhere. It's just a kind of, this is the way they're kind of making it up as they're going along. So I look at celibacy is the big one, but it's just on a sliding scale down to vegetarianism. So it's a toughie, but it's one where it may be that looking back, unlike some other areas, in this case, looking back may not be all that helpful.
Well, I have a private point of view, of course, which is that we set up these special places so that it's possible to feel like the similitude of what would that feel like, because it's the prescription of behavior allows us to feel what would that harmony feel like. It gives us a sense of direction, and that's the purpose of maintaining these institutions. And then maybe here in America, unlike any place for thousands of years, we have the possibility of studying the yogic practice in a different way. So that maybe we could practice it. Maybe we could address the gap with our bodies bit by bit. Each it's not that we attain reality, it's that every time we try it, that's what we're motivated by.
I believe that the objective of Zen is to bring an end to Zen.
We missed the punchline.
We didn't hear you.
I said, I believe that the objective of Zen is to bring an end to Zen.
Bring an end to Zen.
To go beyond Zen. I believe that the objective, let me say it again. I believe that the objective of Zen is to bring an end to Zen. And what I mean by that is that there will be no longer any distinction between monastic and non-monastic. But that in order to do that, we need, or most people need, and I don't say that's an easy thing to do, but that's an objective. In order to do that, we need the monastic life and the ritual. I mean, that's why I believe Dogen says that the painted cake is also real. That is real. We need that, but the objective is to go beyond it.
Yeah.
Back to ritual. I want to check something out with you. I think maybe that I'm saying the same thing as you were saying about the bears and the bear hunters, but I'm not sure. You said ritual is all about control, and that word does not resonate with me, but I think I can understand that. So I wanted to tell you my way of thinking about it and ask you if we're just using different words. Because for the way that I experience it in Zen, and I'm thinking, for example, of a Shuso entering ceremony, which is completely scripted, and yet virtually everybody that goes through it comes away saying, wow, I really meant that. And there's just a little part where you say why you're not capable, and each person says something else. Right? But it's a very, it really strikes a chord for most of us. And I think that it's about enacting with our bodies, enacting our intention, our deep desires. And you were talking about values, so that's why I said maybe we're saying the same thing. I just don't understand it so much in terms of control.
I think what I was saying might be rather trivial compared to where you're coming from, and that's that in order to give expression or to form these feelings and thoughts and intuitions and intentions we have about the world, you need to strictly control the environment. That's
a way of talking about ritual. The ritual is like a control. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just talking about the office. I mean, you sit there, everybody's wearing robes, and you're in rows, and there's a monitor with a stick, and all that. I mean, it's hard to deny that there's something highly regulated.
Yeah.
So I was just pointing out like that obvious element. Yeah.
I'd like to, if I may, I'd just like to share a little bit personal rather, because I have a hard time talking objectively. I was delighted with your talk, and I'd like to, you know, confess that I've never managed to practice Zen with any degree of success, and somehow I'm still here. And I'm about to be apparently in a ceremony, although some people, I think, were teasing me that because I missed the rehearsal this afternoon, it would be 2 years before I was actually going to be admitted. But, you know, I could never sit still. I literally had spontaneous movements. You know, I think if I came to a Zen center today, I couldn't survive because, you know, I wasn't able to follow the schedule. And, I was also very emotional. And you don't do that in Zen. And I'm still like that, and somehow here I am. So I've never had this problem of not being authentic. do I look like that ideal?
No. So
I guess I could call that authentic. You know, that I look the way I do, and what you see is what you get. And so that's my authenticity. And and then I decided to call that Zen. So, anyway, so that all seems to be like a painted rice cake, and that all of, you know, what we do is, it's all, we just make it all up. And then the question is like, well, what do we make up that's like useful, or like Gil yesterday said, skillful, for liberating ourselves or benefiting others and so forth. And it's also interesting to me the kind of conjunction, if I may say again, the people who write about things like Mozart apparently, and this reminds me of Zazen, that Mozart could receive a symphony or an opera in a matter of seconds or minutes, and then he had to spend months transcribing that and putting it in everyday terms that other people could listen to, other people could play and hear also. And it seems to me, you know, we're all doing this kind of work, and it's a kind of, sometimes that translation work from the vertical, which is you know, it's not clear what is in this mindless or, you know, it's not, it's, we don't receive, in sitting, we're not receiving the Ten Commandments or language, and there's a translating of that, or how does, in fact, one bring that into the horizontal, everyday world, and, you know, it's not very clear at all for any of us. We're all working on that, and there's no one place that all that's coming from. So we're all working on, you know, how do we translate some spirit or intention or vow into everyday world, and we're all sorting that out. So that seems to me authentic, anybody who's doing that.
There's a very simple-minded analogy to music. Mozart was able to translate that because he had, you know, the tonal system, and he had a particular notational system that he could use, and a particular tradition, and all that stuff. I mean, that's what I mean by regulated, right? It's very, there's a certain scale, and that's, you know, it's very constrained. And that's what you use. But once you master it, the you know, what it can produce is really infinitely creative and rich. And if there's any, again, those of you who know me, it's been my shtick, that the fear that I have with, as Zen comes to America, is they're not, they're playing with like half a deck. Right? That this focus on, you know, Zazen and meditation, meditative experience, is really not giving, it's not transmitting all of the resources that the tradition actually had available and have always been traditionally part of this transmission. And again, that's why, you know, I like to bring in all of the, just the complexity. And that, at least in medieval China, these debates, they were important. And, you know, people got very wrapped up in them. But it wasn't, that's not what made you a Buddhist. What made you a Buddhist was that you had been raised in, trained in, and knew the language of this very elaborate monastic institution that was capable of doing what Mozart's kind of classical music notation system was able to do, which is give form to it all. Yeah.
I just wanted to say about this discussion earlier about Buddha nature. Dogen says in Busho, when he's quoting the sixth patriarch, he says that Buddha nature is impermanence, which Dogen seems to agree with as a premise. And if you follow the logic of that group, you know, where it goes to is a very deep ethical moral statement about the nature of our place in the universe that is not about what's the word, anthropomorphizing the rest of the world, or about being homocentric. And so it seems to me like it's this very deep statement about the nature of how we are as Buddhists and as people. And it's also, as Kim says, you know, it's a kind of a radical, logical follow-through on the Madhyamaka and the doctrine of non-dual, etc. So when I find statements like that in Dogen and actually use them as a practice and use them as a way to look at the nature of the world and question and try to figure out what in the world that's about, I think that it's it really offers me, anyway, a really enormously vast field to explore about the nature of reality and my responsibilities as a human being within that system.
Is it Busho where he's talking about Hakujo's fox, or is that karma?
I think it's in Busho.
But talk about impermanence or Dogen. So again, those of you who don't like me commenting on koans, this will drive you nuts. But are they all the Mizumi people, by the way? So Dogen says, so everyone knows Hakujo's fox. So Dogen goes through the Chinese masters and says all of them systematically misunderstand this koan. And the basic complaint he has, it's really Dahui that he's focusing on. And he says, Dahui says, well, the words, remember, the words that free the fox are, an enlightened being cannot ignore causation. Which, I'm sorry, from my literary point of view, I'm going to interpret that as an enlightened being is still subject to causation. And he says, Dahui, he's a fool, because what he says, what Dahui is saying, is that there is no difference between causation and non-causation. There's no difference between rebirth and non-rebirth, right? It's just, in other words, Dahui is taking this medial position. He's trying to stand above it all. He's trying to stand in non-duality. So Dogen is saying, the only problem with this koan is we don't find out where the fox was reborn. So you get, that's Joshu's no answer, right? In other words, Dogen cannot take, it can't, he can't mean what he's saying. Right? Dogs have Buddha nature. We all know why Bodhidharma came from the West. He came to the West to transmit the Dharma. And we all know that enlightened beings are not reborn. But Dogen says, they are reborn. Which means, what are you all doing here?
Dinner. I'd like to say you're correct about what you were saying about people reacting to the colors of colons.
Yeah. They're all, yeah.
It's actually the Rinzai tradition.
But also, in Fusho, Dogen quotes Joshua as saying, the dog does have Buddha nature.
Yeah.
So
no, it actually.
When asked, he said, yes, if
those of you who know the critical Buddhism debate that happened some years ago, I think these are the reasons why they do focus on Dogen as a real Madhyamika master. Right? What, in other words, what Dogen understands is the attempt to stand anywhere, including in some sense of, you know, non-duality or whatever, is really, it undermines the critical force of the tradition. Yeah.
You were taking a critical Buddhist perspective by saying Tathagata with good nature is Hindu. Maybe it would be provocative, but I wonder what you would say about the efforts in the tradition, the scholastic tradition or even practice tradition, to mediate between Tathagata and Madhyamaka. For example, the truths in Madhyamaka.
When I say it's Hindu, I don't mean that critically. Because, you know,
I understand, but
what I'm saying is that there is a certain, it's a development that happened that many people have noticed. You get it particularly in the Nirvana Sutra, which really seems to be at odds with an earlier tradition. But what's important historically is that's not in East Asia the way it was seen. It was seen that way by some people. Dogen says, it's an amazing thing, Dogen confides that he asked his teacher Ruching, if the Yuan Zhijian, the Perfect Enlightenment Sutra, is a fake. Now this is, it's an amazing thing for a scholar to look at, because it turns out historically it is a fake.
Yeah.
It is not a translation of an Indian text. How did Dogen know that? It wasn't because he's a philologist or a historian. It's because he said, look, this is so full of this Tathagatagarbha stuff, it can't be Buddhist. But I guess, you know, here I'm
talking about Buddha nature, so there's a way in which,
yes.
It sounds like an abstract question, but it actually gets to how do we see the reality of our practice and our precepts after the vow in the context of nowhere to stand.
So, I can only give, my personal response would be when the Catholic traditions were struggling with, is Christ divine or is he human? Behind that was a real existential issue. You know, to what extent are we ultimately limited by the human condition, or to what extent are we actually a part of the universe, and therefore we have the resources within ourselves for some kind of transcendental understanding. So these things, they look like paradoxes, but they're actually the engine that drives. And this is what allows human beings to transcend themselves. It's precisely that they're able to grapple with these things that lie at the very root of our existence. So when I say it's Hindu, it was, in a sense, it's something that allowed the Buddhist tradition to become much kind of fuller and philosophically much more interesting and sophisticated, because they begin to stop fighting with these guys all the time and say, you know, you guys are deluded because you believe in Madman. And they begin to, in a sense, come round to understanding what a powerful idea an Atman is.
Yeah.
what a powerful idea self is, and that it's not an easy one to shape just by telling yourself over and over again you don't have one.
Why would Jhana, Buddha, I think Hesse comes closest to being a deity in Buddhism, and yet it's not. It's the great paradox, I think, of this Buddha Charles. Who is Vairochana? Is that, if not a deity, then what? That's a question for us.
The Shingon tradition is wonderful on this, because they say that the you know, the tantric scriptures, the Mahavairochana Sutra, for example, was not preached by the Nirmanakaya Buddha. People know this. It was preached by the Dharmakaya Buddha. We talk about kind of, and that's very Zen-y, right? How on earth, right? That's just, it can't be. The Dharmakaya is precisely, it can't preach, it doesn't have a mouth, it doesn't have a body. But they say, no. Vairochana Buddha, who preaches the Mahavairochana Sutra and the Tattvasangraha, he is the Dharmakaya Buddha. I love this.
The first workshop I ever tried to teach at Sensei I called Not Zen, and nobody signed up for it.
So it was packed.
I think one of the things we've inherited from our Japanese ancestors is an aversion to debate. And I also worry about our tradition here in the United States, where we have a tradition which is very polite, and we don't debate. And I also worry that the kind of position that you're putting forward, which I really appreciate, is easily adopted by practitioners as an excuse not to actually wrestle with these issues. So that the third position that you're talking about is very easily adopted by us as a kind of rationale for not really laying it on the line. I see this tendency in myself, and I wonder how we as a community of practitioners could push ourselves more to sharpen swords, you know, with each other, but it's hard because where's the trust and everything else?
Yeah, I would give voice to that. Going back to Ed Fuller, about him being authentically who he is and coming to peace with that. You know, twice today, different conversations, different people. I was called a troublemaker, and I was being, and it happens to me all the time. Being a troublemaker is, and she's one too. There are lots of us in this room that are troublemakers in the best sense of the word. You know, really wanting to grapple with things. And yet, we do have a way of saying, oh, we're getting along so well. I've heard it, you know, it from the people who are directing this wonderful conference. And, oh, you know, the first conference, everyone was kind of at odds, but we're really doing well this time. And my question is, are we? You know, I'm with you.
I think there's what? Another point along the same line I just want to mention briefly is interfaith. We live in a basic Christian Judaic culture. I've been doing a lot more interfaith work, and I'm finding that that is where I think we should engage the debate.
You know, so this is a really interesting conversation. I have to put this in, but it may or may not be appropriate. I think the problem, and this is very pretentious of me, but I think the problem is that the institutions, you don't have enough confidence in the institutions to allow a real debate to happen. You look at rabbis, you look at priests, you look at Catholic priests, right? They're at each other's throats. but they can do that because there's a certain kind of confidence that these debates are not really unsettling the institution as a whole. But the institution here, it really hasn't. The institution is a lot of individuals, so the feeling is, well, if you start to get friction between the individuals, will the whole thing fall apart?
Also, I don't think we're educated well enough. As Buddhists in general, I think our education comes in a kind of scattershot way. And so to present what you just did about the historical analysis of the logic and the discussion about the nature, what is Buddha nature, what is sentient, those kinds of discussions, I think for most of us, we don't have the foundation to be able to use and have a kind of a dialogue with each other, even to dialogue about Dogen and what we think Dogen means or doesn't mean. And so I think that in some ways we have to up our level of discourse and our deeper understanding of the philosophical underpinnings of our school in order to be able to have that kind of a dialogue in that way.
I would say that's why we should have the debates. I was thinking about it, so it'd be real interesting. We sometimes have one of our own, not just outside an academic, stand up in front and give a presentation. Why don't we instead have two people get up, with an interpret, right here, or two of us get up and present different points of view with our limited understanding. I don't think the average Catholic priest knows more about Catholicism, really, than we know about Buddhism. I think we're all up a creek. But so what do we accept that we were up a creek? I think you're right. We don't have a good confidence in our own foundation and that there's a tradition beyond what we ourselves represent, and we have this fear that we'll become somehow knocking each other down. What if the debate was simply to clarify? I would love to having it with Vicky and talking about, say, well, repentance is how I carry it. You know, and we would say, well, poke holes in my repentance. You know, and it would be enlivening if we could take that as a way in which we do what you're saying we need to do, which is to deepen our understanding. But we've been too shy about that. So we argue, one person presents, and then we all present our ideas, rather than just saying, why don't we have that kind of debate? I think it would be really nice thing to return to.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in the last 2 years at Berkeley Zen Center, we've started having priest meetings that after really pussyfooting around each other for a very long time, we started studying at Sojin's suggestion, Yasutani Roshi, a text on karma. It was on karma, right? And we did this for about a year. And I must say, these were totally live, really intense arguments and debates. There were people who were scholars. Eric Green was in this group. People who had studied this stuff. But it's also looking at our practice, looking at our experience, and really bouncing off each other. We can do this. You know, and if we created small groups, say, at one of these meetings in the future, to share a text, if we had, you know, if we broke down into groups of like 8 or 10, we could have really good, everybody, this is such an intelligent group, you know, everybody's not equally educated, but it's such an intelligent group and so grounded in practice, we could actually do this, and it would be really cool.
Another model is Dharma Combat. Every 5th Sunday in Atlanta, we have Dharma Combat, our plus center. It's kind of like a koan exchange, but it's whatever you want to bring to the table.
But I think where this practice is going in this country is, how do we behave in the everyday world? How do we relate to each other in the everyday world? And that makes all this a rice cake, because that's really where it's at. We all want to do the right thing in the everyday world, and we struggle with our inability to do that sometimes, and we keep exploring that. And that's really where the answer is. How was I today in the everyday world? How did I respond to this and that? Did I create suffering? Did I create healing? And that's where the answer is for most people, I believe. So we can do these other things, but that's only, you know, is it a rice cake or is it a step in the right direction? Or what is it?
Yeah.
Excuse me, I don't have much of a voice anymore. But to me, this is exactly the reason why we have ritual, why we have a zendo, is that, yes, we don't do the right thing in the everyday world. And this was brought home to me by what you were saying, that ritual, the zendo, Ryaku Fusatsu, are places where we can come back to, kind of as havens, where we can admit that we didn't do the right thing, and once again get energy is kind of a weird word for it, but get enthusiasm for going back into the world and meeting it once again, knowing full well that we're messy and it's messy and we'll screw up yet again.
I'm a bit confused by what people, what both of you mean by, you know, what's really important is just being a good person in the world. Because, you know, of course, I feel the same way, but I'm not too sure what's Zen about that.
Right, exactly.
That's not the whole thing.
No, it's not about being a good person in the world. It's how do we deal with the fact that it's messy out there. We know it. And we have an idea of how we would like to be. And it doesn't happen that way. That's the Buddha's suffering. But we don't always... One of the ways of helping myself give that up is by coming back and going out again. And it's this process of coming back and going out, I think, that's important.
I'll just throw this out, because
I
don't get a chance to talk to you folks all that much. But if, you know, most religions of the world teach the same thing in terms of just being out there. Right? You be nice to your neighbors and you don't kill people and steal and so on and so forth. And there's a reason they do that. It's because traditions that didn't teach that, there have been many, they don't continue. Right? It's just there's a kind of Darwinian evolutionary thing happening. Well, yeah, I mean, if you're mean to your neighbors and stuff like that, so religions teach basically the same stuff. What Buddhism has to offer, I think, is really very important. They have a critique of a particular understanding of the self that is still very, very relevant. They have an analysis of the way people get drawn into, you know, very dangerous stories, consumer stories and political stories and so on. All this stuff is really valuable. So I guess I'm very sympathetic. What you're really looking for is a way to, you know, be a good person. But as someone is interested in, well, what does Zen bring to this story? That's where I think there are specifics that are really important. And the specifics aren't specific answers, but they're specific ways of framing the question, of getting behind questions, and so on and so forth. I think that's...
That's why we're here.
I'm very confused by this because, and I'm trying to send you a thing, but I disagree. I think we're doing precisely what we should be doing in the everyday world. I think this is the everyday world. This is not an insular, enclosed experience. The doors are open to anyone. I think we are engaged. This is engaged Buddhism.
And one thing you can be very proud of is that this doesn't happen. You do not get members of different lineages in Japan. Or at least, in my experience, it's very rare to get them in the same room with each other.
Just, I want to say, this last exchange, I think, about, you know, this I think is how the tradition now here is different from the examples you cited in the Chinese times. And that's why I think that debate is not the right word. Because I think what we're concerned about is not... I think if we began having an abstract discussion about doctrine, a lot of people would say, forget about it. Because what is interesting to us, I think, and what's important to us and the way that we're practicing is, what does this point of doctrine have to do with how we're living and how we're practicing? That's the concept. So this is not so much a matter of debate as it is a matter of, let's discuss something deep and something real. So, you know what I mean? That's a little different from, let's debate. Okay, the debate is, do sentient beings have Buddha nature or do they not? Insentient beings have Buddha nature. Let's debate that. Because that's not what we're interested in. But we are maybe interested in, let's debate that in terms of what it actually has to do with the way we're practicing. And that's how I understood your paper. You were trying to say these abstract debates actually had something to do. And those are the kind of conversations that we want to have and that we're enjoying now. And that's how I understood what you guys were saying. Let's not be abstract.
But Norman, you can't throw out the text.
No, I'm not saying throw out the text.
You can't throw out the text that's difficult to understand, like Dogen, or something like that, to just say, like, this is one of the problems, I think, with popular Buddhist...
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that.
No, but But when Les was talking about that, Les, excuse me, I'm sure you meant something more deeper than what I heard, which was, it's just about being good people, which then puts it in that realm of, okay, I see you shaking your head. Because obviously there's something about the deeper aspects that pulls up the text that in some ways we don't understand on the surface that pull out in us those questions. Yeah. Like, what does it mean to be unobstructed? What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, so then we're forced to look at what we're doing and to see, and that brings forward a deeper and more subtle understanding of the practice. And that's the hallmark of our particular school in that language and the way that we interpret that, not that we have the only answer, but in those particular ways. So that to me is important too, that it has to be on some kind of deeper level, not just, you know, like reading some easily accessible text that we all read.
There's a couple of ways to be a good person in the world. One is to look at the Ten Commandments or the precepts and to remind yourself every day to follow what somebody else has prescribed. And then there's being a good person in the world without having to look at that. And I think that's where the practice comes in. Mm-hmm. You don't have to put the thing on the wall and remind yourself every day, oh, that's the way I'm supposed to behave. You learn it in some, and I think maybe I'll be contradicting what you said, that there is, ethical behavior does evolve out of practice, I believe. I think we discover that we can be unselfish, and that inherently we are, whereas previously we were unselfish because it was written on the wall. And I think that's where that's the question we keep asking ourselves. How am I in the everyday world, and how is the best way to do it?
There's one way to frame it, I think, kind of gets what Norman was at, is there's a long, long debate about the relationship between emptiness and compassion in the text, which I'm sure you're aware of, but I think that the modern sort of new agey version of Buddhism that I often see here is that compassion arises naturally out of an understanding of emptiness. That's not the position of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. It's very clear, at least my reading, that they are in opposition to each other, and that's why you need to develop both simultaneously.
Or perhaps
complementary. But there is a tension.
Yes.
There's a tension, right, with the understanding that there are no beings out there.
But they're definitely not the same.
Yeah.
Well, that's the big existential question. And that it puts, in my mind, Buddhism right squarely right there. With that tension, that's where we live.
So I wonder whether we're all practicing Buddhism, and so what are we practicing? There lies coming from such different vantage points in some ways. But from my perspective, the basic issue is suffering. How do we see suffering? How do we end suffering? How do we live in such a way that responds to the suffering that we particularly see? And if our practice and our lives aren't somehow addressing that, either internally or in our communities in some way, and are still instead trying to resolve some problem that really does not address suffering, I personally feel we kind of wandered off into the realm of the mind. So, you know, I really, for me, that's a touchstone. Is this addressed the suffering that I feel? Is it addressed the suffering that I can respond to? Is it addressed the suffering that we all are as part of this human world?
On the other hand, suffering is not enough.
What's enough?
Well, going beyond suffering is a very interesting question. How do you work with suffering, experience it, and face it, and also at the same time go beyond it? So I think it's got to all be part of our life.
Sir, show of hands, if people believe in the Four Noble Truths.
Well, I think I was interested in that formulation partly because it tied with what Bob said at the beginning. The position that we're in as individual entrepreneurs puts us in the position often having to speak for the entire tradition.
Yeah.
So each of us is in a predicament of actually embodying the whole canon, whether we like it or not, or whether we even know it. And so that makes our discussion kind of challenging, because each of us is so used to speaking for the tradition. We often say we, you know, what we do and what we believe, and we've lost the confidence in just having an opinion somehow. Anyway, I shouldn't say I have lost the confidence. But each of us, we're all empowered to speak for an entire lineage, and so it's hard to have just ordinary discussions.
Can I respond to Hogan? The other side of responding to compassion, I believe, is creating joy. If it's all about compassion and responding to suffering, then it's sort of a negative thing, you know. But we have the capacity to do positive, creative, fun stuff, and creating joy isn't a way of responding to suffering.
We are wandering off.
It's our show, right?
Yeah. I want to mention, the other day I was talking to somebody, and there's this tree out here, a big magnolia tree that may have to be cut down, and he said, because the roots are breaking in crescendo and lifting up the concrete, anyway, he asked me about whether a tree is centered or non-centered. And we had this discussion sort of right out here about this, and I found myself kind of clobbering a little bit, like, well, this is it. But it was a real question for him, and what are we going to do? Will we do a ceremony? So that was one point I wanted, or just full story. The other thing was about intentions. In reading My Stroke of Insight by Jill Bolte Taylor, this neuroscientist who had a stroke and wrote about it, she was describing during the stroke not being able to tell her arm from the wall and the phone, and the flowing molecules. It was all just one yelling that she couldn't pick out herself. So this illusion that we operate in, the insentience or non-insentience, it just reminded me of that. What is insentient actually, and what is, because of our hardwired, and the way our brains work and our apparatus, this is our delusional world that we swim in it like fish in water. If we can't be removed from it. And those who are greatly enlightened about this delusion, or those who have realization about it, are enlightened. So anyway, that's the thing that's coming up for me in the conversation.
So the simple example, for just what I think I was trying to say in my talk, is no matter what you feel about the sentience or insentience of the tree, you have to perform a ceremony before you chop the thing down. And that's what this tradition has.
They have the ritual that enacts that feeling that we have about what our values are about.
Or that's how they would say they have the technology to propitiate the spirit of that tree.
Yeah.
And it's good for you guys to learn that. I don't know how many of you know it.
Yeah. I think what ritual also offers is a chance for us to, much like maybe the Eskimo hunters, to realize our true self, and by kind of forgetting ourselves in that everyday full-hearted engagement in a ritual. But much like when you're attempting Zazen, we also get to embrace our anxiety and our humanness too, to see that part of the hunting, the painted rice cake, as just as important as the true, if you would, the true self. Both we kind of walk on both feet in that regard with ritual, and maybe with every so-called everyday life.
Don't trees breathe? They breathe in reverse. The Hindus, so sentient and insentient is all kind of, it's like just a concept, really. And Dogen, of course, we know that he said all things are Buddha nature and have, it's a different way way of describing it. All things, all dharmas are Buddha nature. And plants and rocks and creeks and so forth are expressing the Dharma, which is different than preaching. Or preaching is a kind of, you know, way of saying something, but expressing, and so we can see how everything works just by observing nature. I think that's and that's just our connection. A rock is a rock and I'm me, but nevertheless, we're all Buddha nature, right? So that's the expression.
Well, we've passed our time now by quite a bit, so thank you so much.
Thank you.